to understand. Yeah, it worked before.
Here comes the man.
Ah. So to understand where I'm going in this talk, it might be useful for you to recall where I have been, which was most of my career in what I insist was a real physical science, but one with an exceedingly limited basis that allowed lots of room for ideas that you naturally treated with great caution. So I feel compelled first to explain why I now am forced to believe that we have an established cosmological model, and then second, why it is more than my conditioned reflex and distrust of models that leads me to think we're not done with a suitable amount of physics to deal with observational cosmology, let us say, in the next generation. So on this score of caution about the present model, I put at the top the fact that we don't have a magic bullet. There's no one experiment that establishes this model. Instead, we have to build a case around a number of indirect pieces of evidence. Second, we have to remember that when we made this case, we haven't demonstrated that lambda CDM is the final theory so far as observational cosmology goes. It's an approximation that we can always imagine could be improved. And third, I think I'm really grabbed by the fact that the dark sector in our standard model has such vastly simple physics compared to the physics of the visible sector. Is that the way it really is, or only the simplest approximation we can get away with at the present level, which, after all, is not all that detailed? And finally, there is no shortage of interesting puzzles to start worrying about. I plan now to discuss first two examples of why I say there is no magic bullet. This first example is a magic bullet of sorts for a very specified person purpose to demonstrate the presence of dark matter. So here's an image of a cluster of galaxies. The fuzzy spots are the galaxies in the cluster. The arc is the gravitational lensed image of an object that is right in the middle, happens to be along the line of sight through the middle of the cluster. Light from that distant object comes toward us, but somewhere upward to the left, let us say, is gravitationally deflected by the light mass in the cluster and comes toward us at this position. Light arriving to us in this direction left the object slightly downward and to the left, deflected and came to us. Now imagine that with Mond, the force law is 1/r instead of 1/r² at large scales. That would account for the relative motions of the galaxies and the gravitational attraction needed to hold the plasma in the cluster. But consider that if the force law is central to where the visible, whoops, well, I pushed the wrong button, to where the visible stars are, if that is where the attracting mass is, can you imagine that this deflection angle would be so independent of orientation? Surely, this is a demonstration that in this cluster there is dark matter, a magic bullet. It's there. However, if you presented this to supporters of Mond, modified Newtonian gravity, with a 1/r force law at large distances, they could very reasonably say, so there's dark matter in this cluster. How do I know it's not Jupiter's? The answer, of course, would be through other lines of evidence, we have to build our case. A second example, this celebrated anisotropy spectrum for the microwave background radiation. It is a gem, magnificent. But consider a few cautionary notes. It is true that this is based on only 7 parameters, but consider the following points. First, although the measurements are statistically independent, one after another along this curve or pretty close to it, the theoretical predictions are not statistically independent. If you have a theory that allows you to adjust parameters so as to fit here, say, and to fit here, and to fit here, then you won't be surprised if these other points also fit. I don't know how to quantify this, but I think it must be the case that there are fewer independent checks of the theory than there are statistically independent measurements along the curve. Does that sound reasonable? Notice also that we had more than 7 parameters. We had 3 choices. Shall we assume that the structure is triggered by strings or explosions or isocurvature fluctuations in the early universe, or what turns out to be the case, adiabatic fluctuations? We chose among all those options the one that seemed most promising. That means, of course, that we had more choices than the 7 parameters. What is more, let us remember that at 2.3 sigma, a model with 0 lambda and mass density that's rather high, open universe, fits these data equally well. In a Bayesian sense, such a model is disfavored because it requires a very narrow range of values of other parameters. And that is why you sometimes see in analyses of these data the statement that this measurement has established that there is a lambda. But that's only true in the Bayesian sense. A model with 0 lambda fits these measurements. So why are we so strongly in favor of lambda? Well, because of other pieces of evidence. So let us go on now to a line of attack I propose to show to explain, in my mind, the state of the cosmological tests and how well they test our standard lambda CDM model. Here is shown again the anisotropy spectrum, here from WMAP alone, and here a division that was made so that we could be sure that the individual measurements are statistically independent. Here is, for each of these bins in angular scale, the difference between what is measured in the anisotropy spectrum, what is predicted by a model with these parameters, and divided by the standard deviation in the measurement at that range of L's. You notice then the little error flags are of unit length, and this point is 2 sigma off. You find that when you sum the squares, you get 35. One had 7 free parameters to choose. Oh, sorry, yes, and you had 43 of these bins, meaning you expect 36, and you got 35. It's spectacular. But as I said, I'm not sure that this is entirely consistent with saying we have challenged the model 36 times. So instead, let us consider going to other tests in which I propose to establish this very same plot of measured minus model divided by standard deviation. I should caution you that these other tests are not all as clean as this one. It means that some of the standard deviations are going to be a little dicey. We're going to have to live with that. So I propose now to discuss this set of cosmological tests. In each case, I have reduced the test to one or a few numbers that can be compared to the model that was shown in the previous slide. Here again, I take the model prediction, sorry, M is now measured in the change of notation, R is a reference model, and sigma is as before, and here are differences between model and measurement divided by standard deviation for all these cosmological tests. I propose now to go through each of these tests and discuss them. I know that I won't have enough time, and therefore I will ask the chair to tell me when I have 5 minutes left, and I'll go down to the concluding remarks. So here we are to begin with. We talk about the baryon density derived from light element production, helium, deuterium, lithium 7. On the lower left, I have trouble with this dot. On the lower left, an early recognition, maybe this is the first, I'm not sure, by Kem, Yankowski, Spergel, and Tsujiyama, that the anisotropy spectrum is sensitive to the density parameter in baryons. You can see the shapes of different wiggles as you change the density parameter. With the exquisite measurement of the anisotropy spectrum from WMAP, one can determine the baryon density parameter to remarkable precision. This is indeed getting to be precision cosmology, 3 significant figures, dazzling. On the other hand, you have to pause to recollect that this precision depends on the theory. You may make a very precise fit to the wrong theory. How do we know, in other words, that this is an accurate measurement? We know it by making comparisons to other ways to measure this parameter. And in particular, here we have the theory relating the baryon density in units that are archaic, increasing to the right, deuterium divided by hydrogen in the earliest stars. The higher the baryon density, the more you've burned out the deuterium, a lower residual value coming out of the Big Bang. Here is a measurement of an absorption line intergalactic cloud that shows the Lyman alpha resonance absorption line on the side, the deuterium line, a pretty good measurement of the deuterium to hydrogen ratio. That gives you this red line and gives you an omega baryon that is entered here at 0.0219. A larger error. The two, though, are consistent within the standard deviation. This is what really is testing the model. Two exceedingly different phenomena are interpreted within the one theory and give a consistent result. That is the theme of all of these comparisons to come. Here is another one. Here, now, not nearly as precise. In fact, we have a pretty big gap between theory and observation, but worth mentioning nonetheless. Let us ask ourselves the question, what is the baryon density in observed objects in the universe today, and how does it compare to the baryon density those other two measurements wanted? Here is a painstaking list of baryon densities. Here is the dominant entry. It is warm intergalactic plasma either in the virialized regions around galaxies, in the galaxy halos, or in intergalactic medium, a more or less arbitrary cut. But one notices that this component, which adds up to 0.04, is 90% of the total baryon density. That is to say, we have to rely on the postulate that most of the baryons in the universe are dark. This entry is nonetheless worth recording, I believe, because it had the potential to falsify the model. We could have come up with more baryons around us than are seen, than are required by those other two measurements. We didn't fail. Oh, from a painstaking article by Masataka Fujikijita and me. Oh, no, these are all measurements. These two are based on our intuition about where the missing baryons might be. Sorry? These two are not measurements. These all are. These add up to 10%. But the key point here, this was a potential falsification of the model. It survived. Age of the universe. It happens that the anisotropy spectrum pretty tightly constrains the age of the universe, unless you get to very exotic parameter choices, to about 13.6 gigayears. Here is a color magnitude diagram for a globular star cluster, increasing toward the left, surface temperature of the star, increasing vertically, the luminosity, foreground and background stars scattered about. Along here, stars in the cluster, all about the same age, very closely, one thinks. Increasing mass along this line, meaning a higher surface temperature and a greater luminosity, until, as you reach this point, the luminosity has been so high that in the age of the star, it has burned out its central supply of nuclear fuel and evolved upward and to the right. Gorgeous data showing a phenomenon wildly different from anisotropy spectrum, giving an age, well, in this one, 12 gigayears, the number I got from an ensemble is 12.3. Now, to be more careful here, I should have noted that we have to add to 12.3 for the star ages in this old star cluster, the time it took from the Big Bang to the formation of those stars. Because that number is not at all well constrained, and it doesn't matter, the difference is within the standard deviation. I didn't bother to do it. Here is the difference between measured and model divided by the standard deviation. Actually, I let it get a little bit beyond one sigma. It's the least of our problems. So let's carry on. Distance ladder. Here is an illustration of this degeneracy I mentioned. These are all fits to the anisotropy spectrum. In these, well, these are all at 4 sigma, so you don't want to pay attention to all of them, but threading through here, there are found by the Markov chain models that are acceptable at 2 sigma, all the way down to 0 lambda. But you notice the awkward case that if you want to go down here, you have to choose a distance scale that is quite at odds with what the astronomers like. In this situation, the model was chosen, the reference model, to have 0 space curvature, putting you here and demanding a Hubble parameter somewhere near 70. Here is the entry. The fiducial is 72 kilometers per second per megaparsec. Here is an abstract for the painstaking work astronomers do in establishing the distances to stars from which we can get a distance scale for the universe. 2 independent teams analyzing Hubble Space Telescope data. I put the average in here, 69. These folks argue for more like 72, but it, never mind, within the uncertainties, they're consistent. Again, 2 wildly different phenomena giving us the same answer. Another distance scale, which I think merits a separate entry because it works on a different phenomenon and one that is not really very well tested, gravitational lensing. Precision tests within the scale of the solar system, but we're extrapolating from the scale of the solar system, let's say 10 to the 13 centimeters, up to something like 10 to the 25 centimeters in this case. No, I'm sorry, 10 to the 22 centimeters. Well, that's 9 orders of magnitude. You should be a little cautious. But we see here 2 galaxies in the foreground. We see 4 images of a background lensed quasar. This background lensed quasar is a variable radio source. The time variability is picked up in these 4 images, and the time delay gives us 3 time delays, each of about a month, and 2 months. The time delay is a distance difference. Here we have the angles, and trigonometry gives you a distance. Of course, you've got to trust all of the other aspects of this. You have to understand time, the Shapiro time delay going around. You are testing the gravitational deflection of light theory on a big scale here in getting a distance. The distance these folks get after great labor, well, gives you a Hubble parameter 75, which is pretty close to the fiducial model 72. So carrying on. Redshift magnitude relation. Gorgeous piece of work. It was a dream of Alan Sandage in 1961, the ability of the 200-inch telescope to distinguish among world models. He proposed, look at the redshift magnitude diagram. These folks, we have here Brian Schmidt, Adam Riess, and Saul Perlmutter, obtaining a very prestigious prize for this work and actually resolving the dream of Alan Sandage to measure the redshift magnitude relation using quasars or supernova rather than galaxies. Here is Sir Runron Shaw, who founded the prize. I've never seen these 3 look so neat, but I must say that Sir Runron's suit fits better. I bet it was bespoke. Here is a parameter, we needn't bother it to define it, that is a measure of the departure of this line from linearity. Here is the fiducial value, the measured value, again, bang on. We can go on and on. Here is the galaxy autocorrelation function. It is measured as an angle in the sky with roughly, angle in the sky. If you assume a simple scale invariant power spectrum of density fluctuations in what is now the lambda CDM model, but in this here was CDM, you see that the predicted cutoff on large scales is a dotted, very barely visible line. These people pointed out already in 1990 that the data fit a much larger cutoff as if there were a cosmological constant. It's an interesting illustration of the power of an idea. that this was taken not as evidence for lambda by the general community, but rather an evidence for a departure from a scale invariant spectrum. It worked, tilted CDM for a while, but people were at last driven to accept, no, I think I'd better imagine that this is the effect of a low-density universe. It doesn't directly point to lambda, only low mass density, but within the model, we see a prediction, a fiducial value, a measurement, and again, consistency. So we can carry on. This is getting dull, isn't it? Except, isn't it dramatic to consider such a wild variety of phenomena that are all hanging together with this standard model? Here, variant acoustal oscillation. One sees wiggles in the microwave background radiation anisotropy spectrum, a result of the oscillations of the plasma radiation fluid in the early universe. Those same oscillations perturb the baryon distribution at decoupling, which perturbs the mass distribution, which gives acoustic oscillations in the power spectrum for matter. The oscillations are more or less sinusoidal. That means that the Fourier transform, which is the autocorrelation function, has a peak. This peak was in the literature, 84? It's almost half a century ago. At last, it's seen. There it is. My goodness. And it translates to a parameter constraint, which again is consistent with the model. Here we have dynamical estimates of mass. I put that image up on the upper right simply because it's pretty. It's the two-point correlation function of galaxies, but measured in redshift space. So the radial distance is redshift. That makes the two-point correlation function anisotropic because relative motions of galaxies were add or subtract to the redshift, and so give an error in the distance. Of course, the transverse separation is fairly secure because the angles are small, and so a small error in distance doesn't make much damage. The result is an anisotropic spectrum in which we have elongation along the line of sight in for galaxies that are very close because they tend to be moving around each other, and the random motions away or toward gives us this elongation in the two-point correlation function for points that are close to along the line of sight. For points that are away from that, one sees a flat thing. I hope you can see that this is slightly flattened. That is the result of galaxies streaming together as they're being pulled together by their gravitational attraction. That gives a measure of a mass density. The measure that's entered is actually this one, which is a little more subtle. I think not worth taking the time to explain, but there it is. Looks pretty good again. And this goes on and on. Shall I go to the end? I should pause to remark that there are in this table, how am I doing for time? Oh, 30. Oh, 10 minutes, okay. Here is the RMS fluctuations in counts of galaxies within a sphere of radius 8h⁻¹ megaparsecs, an archaic measure, but convenient and so preserved. One has a very precise measure of the RMS fluctuations in counts of galaxies within this randomly placed sphere of around 10 megaparsecs radius. One has a very tight constraint on that same parameter within the fiducial model. The two are different by many standard deviations. No one is surprised, because galaxies can't be perfect traces of mass. The sigma 8 value depends on the mass of the kind of galaxies you select, their luminosities. On the other hand, because galaxies are attracted by gravity in the same way as dark matter, it would be uncomfortable, I think, if the two differed very much. There was a time when it was thought that the two did differ very severely. I never could buy that. It just was ugly. I'm glad now that nature has seen its way clear to making galaxies trace pretty well mass. Not exactly. There is statistically very significant difference between the two. I don't know how to quantify, though, the fact that this could have been a big difference, and that would have, not, if not falsified the model, certainly made it look a lot less likely in my mind. On the other hand, I can't very well put in a number of standard deviations here. It would be way off the chart anyway. What else do we have? Oh, another interesting historical fact, a challenge to cosmological orthodoxy. A cluster of galaxies is so large that to a good first approximation, it gathers together dark mass and baryons alike. That means that in a cluster of galaxies where you can measure the baryonic mass, you see it, it's mostly in plasma, the plasma radiates and is observable in X-rays, you get a temperature and a density. The dark matter in a cluster you can estimate from dynamics. You can take the ratio of dark matter to visible matter. You know the luminosity, the luminosity per unit mass. We know the cosmic mean luminosity by counting galaxies. Convert that into a cosmic mean mass density. In this paper, they were shocked to discover that if you do that calculate that a little analysis, you find that our universe is not Einstein de Sitter. It has a low mass density. A shock at the time, but perfectly consistent within the measurements with this standard model. In fact, I am at the end. Glory be. So here is the result. Here are models, measurements, minus reference model divided by standard deviation. Square them and add them. You get 26. The number of independent measures is 16. I didn't have any degrees of freedom. That was all fixed in fixing the anisotropy spectrum and some theoretical prejudices. And so I should expect that this sum is around 16. It's too big. But you pause to remember that some of these standard deviations are awfully dicey, very difficult to make. And so my intuition says this is superb, a magnificent fit. And as I say, what really grabs me is so many different ways of looking at the world around us gave us such very consistent answers. That tells me not that lambda CDM is the ultimate answer, but rather that when we get a better theory, it is going to predict a universe that looks very much like lambda CDM. We know that because we've looked at the universe in so many ways, and it's worked. It really is impressive to me that that's happened. I never imagined it would. On the other hand, I have the conditioned reflex of distrusting anything to do with cosmology. And so I will offer you an example of why I feel nervous about lambda CDM as the theory for the universe. Here is a numerical simulation. Out of it has been selected those massive halos that are most massive. There are particles all over the place, of course, but only those that are within the nominal, statistically relaxed, virialized part of the system have been plotted. All dots that are outside this region are simply not plotted in either panel at redshift 0 or at redshift 1. In the center is a sphere with radius about 15 kiloparsecs. That's about the radius of the stellar part of a standard giant elliptical galaxy, the biggest galaxies known. Here are where these particles are at redshift 1. The luminous particles, the white particles are, of course, seen, scattered about. The particles that are in the center here now are in these black spots at redshift 1. They're visible because they stayed in dense spots where there are lots of less dense dark matter particles present. So here is the prediction of lambda CDM. It is an n-body simulation and a pure dark matter simulation. On the other hand, stars in giant elliptical galaxies formed at pretty high redshift. We can be pretty sure, I think, that almost all stars now in a giant elliptical galaxy and in this black spot were stars at redshift 1, and hence were moving like dark matter particles. So to a good approximation, I think, we have a description of what a giant elliptical looked like at redshift 1. You see that it is scattered all over the place. The scale here is physical. This is 2.5 megaparsecs, which is to say somewhat larger than the size of a rich cluster of galaxies. This is a prediction, which I think you have to trust because it came out of Simon White's numerical n-body sweatshop in Garching. It makes me feel very nervous because it says that the material now in a giant galaxy was at redshift 1, scattered all over the place, and therefore surely is telling us what the environment all over the place was like. That's not what one sees when one looks at galaxies' properties. Here is a plot showing, for these early type, gas-poor, large galaxies, a plot of log velocity dispersion. This is surface brightness, so it's log radius, log luminosity, in a combination that happens first to show the general correlation among galaxy types. Mass, luminosity, and velocity dispersion are well correlated in these large galaxies. Second, it happens to show in this red line what you would get if these galaxies are in statistical equilibrium. So there's mass scales as velocity dispersion squared times radius, and if mass to light were constant. The tilt you see, which is very evident, tells us that the ratio of total mass in one of these galaxies to their luminosity increases with radius as about the 1/3 power. Now, the exciting thing about this is that the data have been divided into two subsets: the galaxies that are in low density regions and the galaxies that are in high density regions. The cut needn't concern us. It is a distinction between galaxies that are in low density regions, galaxies that are in high. And you notice that they are very similar. They're not identical. Up here is a cut running across which shows, with the exquisite statistics of this sample, a systematic difference. Galaxies in low density regions tend to be a little brighter than galaxies that are in high density regions. But what a small effect it is. To an excellent approximation, these distributions are the same. Galaxies are island universes. How is it that the galaxy knew that if it was going to end up being massive, it had better collect more mass relative to light than it were going to be of low mass? It doesn't seem to ring true with what the simulations are saying. Here is another example, and this is my last. Here, showing statistics from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, and I should have remembered to remark, these come from Sloan also. But here, another sort of demonstration. Here, luminosity along the bottom axis increasing to the right. Here, color from blue in the bottom to red in the top. Here, three different slices: galaxies in low density regions, high density, and exceedingly high. It's a wonderfully informative diagram showing systematics of galaxies. You see the blue tail down here, which goes away as you go to more dense regions. Galaxies that are blue are star forming, and they tend to avoid dense regions. You notice that along this line, the right-hand part edges further to the right as you go to denser regions. The most massive galaxies like to be in dense regions. But the thing that really grabs me is this solid line is the same in each of these plots. It is tilted, and it is the color magnitude relation for early type galaxies. If an early type galaxy is massive, it is redder than if it's of low mass. We needn't bother about why that is, but rather to marvel at the fact that this correlation is present in high and low density regions. It means that when a galaxy was assembled at the present time out of that helter-skelter distribution of where the stars and dark matter were at redshift 1, it knew that if it was going to be massive, it had better be red. How in the devil could that be? I have no answer. Lots of speculation, of course. But I come down to my bottom point. Number one, despite my conditioned distrust of all ideas in cosmology, I've got to be deeply impressed with the standard Lambda CDM model. It is a good approximation to reality. But I am very uneasy about the fact that the dark sector is so blessedly simple compared to the visible sector. And I count examples such as this as a reason for thinking that maybe the next better cosmology is not that far off. We have some pressing issues. Of course, it's always possible that this is simply the result of the complexity of the physics of galaxy formation. If so, nature has done a wonderfully subtle job in puzzling me, perhaps you. Thank you.
questions?
Jim, could you put up your laundry list again? Or?
My laundry list.
Yes, if you don't mind. Yes, okay. So I think I had a few objections to this. One was the cluster baryon fraction.
Yeah.
And I don't know where you got the number from, right? Because I think it's much lower than thing that what
so this is a combination, you notice, baryon density, Hubble parameter, total matter density.
So this is from Simon White's paper, or
sorry,
this is from the Simon White's paper, or
well, it is a much more recent one. It is Allen,
yeah,
who did the studies first in Cambridge, now in Stanford.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there is a controversy about that, because there are other people who say it's much lower.
I'm not familiar with the controversy.
Okay.
I wonder how. Well, this one doesn't look too different.
Yeah, that doesn't. That are different.
I wonder which way you would push it.
It's lower. That's.
This combination is lower.
Yes, the measured value from extra clusters is lower.
Well, it'd help bring chi-squared into line, wouldn't it?
No, it wouldn't.
No, it goes the other way.
The measurement is lower.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is the canonical value. This is already low, and you want to lower it some more.
Yes.
Could be an interesting problem.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. This is an example of slightly complicated physics. There is in here a correction for the baryons lost when the cluster formed. Mm-hmm. That is based on simulations. Do you trust them?
No. That's
fair enough.
More questions?
Yep. So actually, I was reading this a completely different way. I think this addresses a very interesting question I've always had, which is, what do the error bars mean in astrophysics? So I think if you take that number and divide by the number of degrees of freedom, what it tells you is the errors on all of these are underestimated by a factor of 1.6, which sounds
right.
About right.
It's not on there? In previous versions, I've had that factor.
Okay. So, I mean, that's very interesting compared to this. You know, doing the CMB test.
Yeah.
So.
You should be a little careful, of course. There's a strong tendency not to publish when you get the wrong answer.
Okay.
All of us, no matter how honest and scrupulous, are prey to that. That's why Art MacDonald had the sealed box in analyzing his data. We can't work that way, but we have to bear it in mind. So, yes, I'm startled at how well this nominal chi-squared works. I'm not at all uneasy that it's a bit high. Maybe I'm uneasy that it's not higher.
So if there are no further questions, let's thank Jim again.